The sermon's going to begin a little differently than many do here, which is still lovely. In the Gospel according to Matthew, Jesus sits down at the edge of the sea and begins to teach. He shares a parable about a sower who lets his seeds fall on different kinds of ground, a path where the seeds are swept away by the wind, rocky ground where the seeds cannot set deep roots, thorny ground, and finally, fertile ground where the seeds yield a good crop. Jesus ends by saying, "Let anyone with ears to hear listen." Then he breaks down the meaning of the story for the gathered people. He says, "When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what is sown in the heart. This is what was sown on the path. As for what was sown on rocky ground, this is the one who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. Such a person has no root, but endures only for a little while. And when trouble or persecution arises on account of the word, that person immediately falls away. As for what was sown among the thorns, this is the one who hears the word, but the cares of the world and the lure of wealth choke the word, and it yields nothing. But as for the one that was sown on good soil, this is the one who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and yields." This passage and Jesus' ministry emerge from the prophetic tradition in the Hebrew Bible. Prophecy in the religious sense is reading the signs of the times, understanding the present moment clearly, and speaking clearly about its implications for the future. This work, this prophetic work, is part of the work of the church to make sense of our own historical moment, to hold up a mirror to society, to see and name where we've gone astray, and to point out an alternative path toward a more hopeful future. At first blush, it would appear that the prophetic tradition is mostly about speaking up honestly and courageously. But what I love about this parable is its emphasis on listening. The parables and the prophetic tradition are relational. Every story must have its audience. Every prophet speaks in relation to a community. The prophets speak, but just as important, they listen. They listen for understanding and clarity and truth and wisdom, sometimes unwillingly. It's been a hard stretch of weeks. The news at home and abroad has left me feeling sad and angry and concerned. There's been hope in the mix, too, but if I'm honest, simple, stunned grief has dominated my emotional world. Philando Castile and Alton Sterling were shot and killed by police officers a little over a week ago, and their deaths were caught on film. Not long afterward, 5 Dallas police officers were shot and killed by a sniper. It's time to speak about the issue of race in our country. It's time to listen to the promptings of the prophets of our time. Anyone with ears to hear, let them listen. The Black Lives Matter movement began with 3 black women, community organizers, 2 queer and 1 straight, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi. They had participated in a leadership training program together, and they were friends, and they were Facebook friends. The movement got its start not long after a man named George Zimmerman killed a black unarmed teenager in his neighborhood, a young man named Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman was charged with second-degree murder, but was ultimately cleared of all charges. Alicia Garza followed the case and reeled when the verdict came down. She wrote a post on her Facebook page in response, what she called a love note to the black community in a time of grief. The post said simply, "We are enough. We are enough. And we don't deserve to die just because somebody else is scared of us. Our presence is important and we matter. Black lives matter." Garza's two friends responded positively, and one of them created the hashtag Black Lives Matter. A movement was born, a peaceful movement, to address the long-standing issue of police brutality in Black communities. The movement grew, and the phrase became a rallying cry in the demonstrations that have marked the deaths of Freddie Gray and Tamir Rice and Sandra Bland and so many others. The movement is bigger than its founders, but the purpose of the organization that they founded is pretty straightforward. They say, Black Lives Matter works toward a world where Black lives are no longer systematically targeted for demise. We affirm our contributions to this society, our humanity, and our resilience in the face of deadly oppression. To me, Garza sounds a lot like the great Ella Baker in 1964. If you don't know about Ella Baker, you should. She is an amazing woman. Baker was a pivotal figure in the civil rights movement, and she said then, "Until the killing of Black men, Black mothers' sons, is as important to the rest of the country as the killing of white men, white mothers' sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest." And she said, "Remember, we are not fighting for the Negro alone, but for the freedom of the human spirit, a larger spirit that encompasses all mankind." Anyone with ears to hear, let them listen. There's been a backlash against Black Lives Matter. It's been called racist. It's been accused of inciting violence, just as civil rights activists were accused in the 1960s. Worse still, the movements and its concerns have been discounted in subtle ways. An All Lives Matter counter-message has sprung up. And while on the face of it, this message seems benign, it has a dangerous undertone. Of course, all lives matter. Here at South Church, we celebrate the worth and dignity of all people, and this affirmation is a central part of our mission as a faith community and as a faith tradition. We preach unity and connectedness and peace here, and we sing hymns that celebrate the interconnectedness of the human family. We sing, "We would be one." But some interpretations of that philosophy, that theology, are harmful. I remember the impact of these messages when I was a child, or similar ones. The white people in my world meant well when they said things like, "I don't see you as Black at all. I see you as a friend or student or colleague or fill in the blank." Or they'd say, "When it comes down to it, we're all the same." These statements emerged out of an ethic of race blindness. But the message I received, the message I walked away with was, "I'm only able to see your humanity once your Blackness becomes invisible to me." And the impact was that there was nowhere to go with the real issues I faced as a young Black person growing up in a predominantly white community. The country was founded on July 4th, 1776, with soaring words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Thomas Jefferson originally included a passage in a draft that addressed the issue of slavery, but it was removed after a heated debate. Instead, the question of how Black people should relate to these soaring affirmations was simply ignored. Black people were left to navigate the disparity between our national narrative of freedom and opportunity and the reality of their lives, which at the time was slavery. This wasn't abstract then, and it isn't abstract now. It's an issue, it's a concern, it's a challenge that has persisted over centuries. Last month, I preached about the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis in 1968, when strikers carried signs that read, "I am a man." These folks were striking for safer working conditions and for their dignity as human beings. I remember a conversation I had with an older black man living on the street several years ago. I was walking through Harvard Square, and he called out to me. And I'm not sure how, it just happened, but we got to talking on the street, sort of uncomfortably, but honestly, about church and God and life. At some point, after 10 or 15 minutes, he looked at me and said, "They said we were 3/5 of a man," referring to the language of the Constitution. His face crumpled, his body bent, and he stood and he wept on that sidewalk as dusk fell. We were quiet. There wasn't really anything else to say. And in the end, I know we both felt better. We said our goodbyes and went our separate ways. But I've never forgotten him. Our country has a long history of embracing a national narrative of opportunity and liberty, while actively denying freedom and opportunity to black people and other people of color. And for centuries, black people have been expected to keep the illusion of equality going. As a people, we practiced the rituals of deference and deception that corroded our souls and allowed white America to continue its delusion comfortably. In the 50s, this meant addressing white people formally, even as black people were addressed informally, across big age ranges. It meant accepting subpar public accommodations and schools and sitting at the back of the bus as if this were the natural way of things, as if it were benign. These days, it means broadcasting, just sort of emanating a demeanor of respectability and harmlessness, engaging in rituals of reassurance that we are not aggressive or criminal or dangerous. This dynamic is part of the fabric of black life. Either the embrace of these demands or defiance against it. It's exhausting. And what's more, it really doesn't work. Neither stance ensures personal safety. I was touched by the words of trauma surgeon Brian Williams after the murder of 5 police officers in Dallas last week. Dr. Williams treated the man who was died, and he was clearly very shaken as he spoke about his intense and complex feelings about recent events. He bounced around as he spoke. He's a middle-aged black man. He said, "This experience has been very personal for me. There was the dynamic of officers being shot. We routinely care for multiple gunshot victims, but the preceding days of more black men dying at the hands of police officers affected me. I think the reasons are obvious. I fit that demographic of individuals, but I abhor what has been done to these officers, and I grieve with these families. I understand the anger and the frustration and the distrust of law enforcement, but they are not the problem. The problem is the lack of open discussion and the impact about the impact of race relations in this country. And I think about it every day," he said, "that I was unable to save those cops when they came through that night. It's been on my mind constantly. This killing, it has to stop. Black men dying and being forgotten. People retaliating against the people that were sworn to defend and protect. We have to come together and end all this." Williams went on to say that when he sees police officers eating at a restaurant, he picks up their tab, and that once a year or two ago, he bought a Dallas police officer an ice cream cone when he was out with his daughter getting ice cream. She's 5. He says, "I want my daughter to see me interacting with police that way so that she doesn't grow up with the same burden I carry when it comes to interacting with law enforcement. I want police officers to see me, a black man, and understand that I support you, I will defend you, and I will care for you, but that doesn't mean I don't fear you." And a few days later, he added his hope that more conversations about race were starting to happen across racial lines. He said, "There really is, in my opinion, no chance of having any true sustainable change until we are at least willing to acknowledge that black men are targeted in all segments of society. Once you acknowledge that, you can actually move forward and address why this is happening and come together to make this country a much better place for our children. There's so much to do, so much to take on. We begin by acknowledging the depth of the problem, by refusing to sweep it under the rug. 2 years ago, after the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, we had a vigil in this sanctuary and in this courtyard. One of our youth stood up, a black youth, during the period of open reflection. She quoted Dr. King from his letter from a Birmingham jail. She said, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." And she returned to her seat. This is no time for silence. Let us learn to speak with one another, and let all with ears to hear listen. May it be so.